Hey everybody, it's your friends, Brad and Dave.
And we're just dropping into your feed to tell you about a special offer this month.
Here's the special offer. Join us on Patreon at the $5 level and you'll get
an exclusive episode of Drunk Comic Lab.
It's a Patreon-only hour of us talking comics while suitably soused.
Oh, you will regret missing this. Brad is a delight.
And when you join, you'll also get an ebook of how to make web comics.
That's right. This is our how-to book on web cartooning that's now gone through 4 successful printings at Image Comics.
And when you join us on Patreon, you'll also get an ebook of the Webcomics Handbook.
So now that's 2 ebooks you're getting. This one with over 200 pages of actionable advice and how-tos that you can apply to your cartooning today.
So that's the scoop. Join us before Thanksgiving,
November 28th.
And get 2 free ebooks plus the exclusive episode of Drunk Comic Lab.
Gang, you already know you love the show, and here is your chance to join us on Patreon and get 3 cool freebies.
And if you're already at the $5 level or higher, all you gotta do is stick around. You'll get your reward on the 29th.
Now, everybody, let's talk comics. So, Brad, a few months back, we were at Disneyland as a family, and we were, I don't know what we were doing over in the California Adventure area, but there was a Toy Story ride, right?
Mm.
And I happened to say out loud, huh, Tom Hanks sounds weird there, right?
Yeah.
Something to that effect. And one of the Disney cast members looks to me, you know, in the kind of conspiratorial way that only adults, like there's no kids around, he goes, well, that actually isn't Tom Hanks. And I go, what? And so it turns out that Tom Hanks, by the way, works an incredible schedule, works 9 months out of the year and then takes the rest of the summer off, right, mm-hmm. apparently. And these are all apparently's. I don't know this firsthand, but yeah. I thought this was interesting. And then for anything where he gets a role, but it needs either ADR work that's not super critical to him, or it has like ancillary, like commercials or toys, like for Toy Story.
Yeah.
Or a Pizza Hut commercial tied into Toy Story's promotion for the movie or whatever it is. Tom Hanks doesn't do the voices. He contractually works it in that his brother Jim Hanks,
oh my God,
does the voiceover work for Tom Hanks in those situations.
Oh my God. And I guess Jim Hanks can do a passable Tom Hanks impersonation?
I guess it's reasonably good enough so that 80% of the time you're like, yeah, that's Tom Hanks. Yeah, that's fine. That's Tom Hanks.
That's amazing. Something that it doesn't go to like a professional voiceover artist who specializes in impersonations. It's much better to write it into the contract that it goes to your brother.
Yeah, there's a lot of potential jokes to be had here. Like, what if Jim Hanks has just like one tooth and Tom is like, oh, I got to get him some work. He just sits on the couch all day. He's like, okay, so we're bringing in, so Mr. Jim Hanks, are you ready to go? Yeah, let's do it. Let's record. I sound exactly like Tom. Let's record this voiceover for the Pizza Hut commercial.
And then what they do is they got to put it through auto-tune and everything. And by the time they're done with it, they make him sound like Tom Hanks. But in the first opening shot, in the microphone, it's, well, hell, you are, I'm a toy.
I love that Disney has worked out like a baseline auto tune for Tom Hanks. So yeah. Jim Hanks comes in, he's like, all right, so what do you want? You want me to do a standard Tom Hanks? All right, here we go. Bada bing, bada boom, I'm a toy. How you doing? Look at me, I'm a toy. Bing, bang, boom, buy some Pizza Hut. Hey. And then they run it through the filter and it's like, hey, Buzz.
I personally love Bing Bang Boom, buy some Pizza Hut.
That's it. Oh, that's not on the script. I thought I'd improvise. Anyway, I'm Jim Hanks. Gotta go.
Well, as a matter of fact, I should probably tell you, Dave, that I knew you were going to do that cold open. I've actually got Jim Hanks to come in and do the Comic Lab intro. And the nice people at Disney are going to make it sound so that it actually sounds like you and me. Believe it or not.
Right, I'm looking forward to whatever this bit is. Here we go, everybody. I anxiously say hi, everybody, and welcome to Comic Lab, the show about making comics.
And making a living from comics. I'm Brad Geiger, editor of webcomics.com. And, hold on. Beep. And cartoonist of Evil Inc.
You became much suaver than the normal Brad Geiger.
Well, it's Disney. They always polish this stuff up.
You auto-tuned it a little bit too much to Sex Machine there, I think. Here, I'm going to hit that same button. Boom. And I'm Dave Kellett, cartoonist of Drive and Sheldon, and co-director of Stripped.
And this week's Hour of Comics Advice is made possible. Hold on, I'm going to do radio announcer button. Beep. By your support at patreon.com/comiclab. So Dave, let's talk comics.
Hey, you're tuning in to Stinkfinger and the Gerb at 102.9, the traffic hour coming up. I love how radio DJs always have the stupid name, you know? It's like, what are you, four? All right, anyway, I don't know where I'm going with that. Now I'm just becoming like Old Man Yells at Cloud.
What is it with radio people and their names?
What's with shoelaces? All right, so let's dive right into the show, my friend.
Yes.
So I wanted to talk to you about a topic that it's not necessarily top of mind, but every time I see it, I'm always like, I grit my teeth a little bit.
Yeah.
And that's this: when someone emails me, especially someone out of the blue, and it's for a second or third party that I'm aware of, but don't really read or follow. And they go, Dave, you got to help us save this Kickstarter. Can you tweet? Can you share it? Can you blog?
No.
You've got to save this Kickstarter.
Yeah.
Oh, we could all pull together and save it. And Brad, I want your advice on this because I never do it, but I always think like the fundamental job of a Kickstarter is market testing.
Yes.
And if it doesn't work, if the book is not going to go, that's a huge gimme towards not wasting a lot of money. Like, if you ask Brad Geiger or Scott Kurtz or Dylan McConnis to save a Kickstarter,
yeah,
you're failing the basic idea of the market testing that is Kickstarter. Am I wrong there?
No, you're absolutely right. And it puts you in a really bad position. In other words, we've said on this show 100 times, Kickstarter is free market research. And if you fail at a Kickstarter, it's not a failure. It just means that you weren't ready for the market or the market wasn't ready for you. And you need to take that information and come back and use it thoughtfully and creatively, and maybe come back next year and try it again. And for I've got kind of a fundamental problem with getting involved in that, because if that Kickstarter is failing, and let's say that through some stretch of the imagination, my tweet turns it around for them, which, by the way, is never going to happen.
That Brad Geiger magic touch.
Well, no, it's anybody. I mean, listen, if that Kickstarter is failing, it's failing
for
a reason.
No, but in that instance, I'm seeing you as Michelangelo's hand reaching out, touching the other fingertip, like, "Hi, Brad Geiger, deem the Kickstarter saved."
Yes, I'm going to spread some of that magic and touch it off. But listen, if that Kickstarter is failing, it's going to fail whether I get involved in or not. And in a amazing fantasy world where I make the difference, I didn't do those folks any good, because they have now gotten involved in a project that really doesn't have the backing that it needed to come into fruition. And they're Kickstarter funded, but they're going to have problems further on down the road. If it's a book, they're not going to have sales past that first book. You know, if it's a movie, they're going to have problems when it comes time to launch that movie. I don't want to get involved in a Kickstarter that's failing. It's hurtful. Nobody likes to see a Kickstarter fail. Nobody relishes that, but that's part of the process. And that Kickstarter needs to fail so that they can learn from it and come back and be a better thing. Getting involved now to try to save a Kickstarter is preventing that better thing from coming up later on down the road. Don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, part of it is, we should distinguish, by the way, between different types of Kickstarters, because there's also like charity Kickstarters where people are more likely to reach out to their broad spectrum of people they know and follow and say, hey, can you chime in on this, whatever charity? And that's a little bit different.
Yeah.
I will acknowledge that that's a different situation because there's no inherent built-in audience for a charity book or a charity project.
Or a GoFundMe.
Right. Or a GoFundMe. Exactly.
Yeah.
What I'm getting at here is like, I'm going to use me in this situation, Brad. Mm-hmm. Somebody emails you, right, and says, Brad, can you save Dave Kellett's Kickstarter? He's kickstarting a book, and there's 2 days left, and it doesn't look like it's going to make it. Can you save Dave Kickstarter? So, Brad, you can absolutely choose to promote my Kickstarter, right? Mm-hmm. But here's what's happening. Usually, Kickstarters are transferring the goodwill, the entertainment, the shared sense of friendship and value that people have already longstanding from reading your work over time. But if Brad Geiger sends his Evil Inc. readers over to save a Sheldon Kickstarter,
yeah,
they kind of are discovering it for the first time, which means the signal-to-noise ratio of people that look versus people that back is going to be incredibly high. It's going to be a lot of people that look and maybe two people that back, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah,
that's what Brad means by like as though it's likely that I'm going to save the project, because any of us pointing any of our readerships to something else, they're discovering that new thing for the first time, right?
Yeah.
But also, the bigger problem is that, like, Brad, can you save Dave's Kickstarter? Dave's not going to make it with 2 days left. The problem is I have either not built up the shared sense of entertainment and value yet with my readership, mm-hmm, I, Dave Kellett, with Sheldon, or this particular project is not sparking with them. Like, they've seen it, right? That's,
yeah,
the second one.
Yeah.
Or the third one is I have not built up an effective way to communicate to my own audience. I don't know how to reach them to tell them I have a Kickstarter. So in all three of those cases, the fault is not with Brad not linking me, which we've already agreed is going to have very minimal impact.
Mm-hmm.
The fault is that I've got to do better on managing my career before,
right,
I launch that Kickstarter and managing that project and then communicating with my project.
Yeah.
Brad, what are your thoughts? I'm sorry. I feel
besides,
like I'm talking too much.
I mean, that's everything that we've said has been pretty much, you know, very nice and even-handed. Let's get down to brass tacks. How many times have you gotten that email, went over and looked at the Kickstarter and said, oh, geez, this is really good? That's never happened. It's never happened to me. I just recently, within the last several months, somebody did this to me through Instagram, and I went over and it was like I'm not going to say what it was, but it was like a project, and I looked at this thing, and the video alone for it was so deadly horrible that I'm like, oh, I don't want to send people to this. This is not good. This is,
yeah,
not a good project. I don't want to, if I'm going to send people to something, I want it to be something that I at least have a little bit of feelings about in a positive way. 9 chances out of 10, these Kickstarters are failing because they're not very good. And they,
yeah,
need to have that experience so that they can get good.
Brad, let's recontextualize this before we put a button on this. I think there's one other way to demonstrate why there's an inherent problem here.
Yeah.
About it not being good. Someone comes to you and goes, Brad, Dave's got, I don't even remember, 9,000 followers on Twitter. He just made a tweet and no one has liked it, Brad. What can you do to get those likes up, Brad? Brad, what can you do to save that tweet and get those likes up to 100? Brad, what can you do to make that not very good tweet get a lot of likes? What can you do?
Yeah, what can I do? Go back in time and pull this person aside and tell them about social media so that in 3 or 4 years they'll be better grounded. I don't know. What can I do? I don't know what I can do.
Right. Well, so that's the problem here is that the onus, the major weight of it is that if you take that Kickstarter is market testing a product, is market testing the love and the joy and the entertainment value that an audience feels for an artist, then there's not much that third parties can do. They can obviously, we can all make, a little bit a PR buzz for something to help, because maybe people don't see in the way that algorithms limit us all. Mm-hmm. Maybe they don't see this tweet, but they'll see that tweet. So yes, there is a general sense of a rising tide could help a project, but it's asking a lot when a project is market failing for other people to be asked to come, quote unquote, save it.
Yeah.
Because that is the purpose of Kickstarter, is the market test that brings a product to market if there is an audience for it. Right, Brad?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So listen, Dave, I've got a question for you.
Okay.
And this comes from our $5 Patreon backer, George Mackay.
All right.
And he says, "All right, guys." That's what he said. You can know how he goes, you know how people can follow you on Patreon without being a supporter. In other words, they're not backing you, they're not pledging, but they are following you. And I'll go into that in a minute. How do I convert these buggers and get them on board? Loving the show, highlight of my week. It really is, he says.
So ah, that's nice.
Yeah. So first of all, we should probably, do you know what a follower is? Because I didn't. I had to look it up.
Brad, here's how professional I'm going to sound here. I yeah. did not know this existed or was a thing. So get ready for a high quality answer from Dave Kellett on how to make this happen. I actually do have a thought on it now that we're saying it out loud. But I did not know that Patreon had quote unquote followers that were different than patrons. So, Brad, right. I feel like you already have a leg up on me. So what is it? How does it work? What does it do?
So this was kind of on the periphery of my radar. I kind of knew about it. But before I was doing show prep, if you would have asked me, you know, what the ins and outs were, I couldn't have told you. Basically, a Patreon follower since they are following you on Patreon, they get a notification every time you make a public post so they can go and look at that post. They're not paying, they're not pledging. But if you make a public post, they will get pinged and they can come over and look at your public post.
Ah.
So I looked at mine and because of how I run my Patreon, and that's going to become a really important part of the comments that I've got coming up. I looked at my followers, which you can find out how many people are following you on Patreon by going to your relationship manager. And the first little section there is, I think, membership types. And one of those membership types is followers. And you can click on that and find how many followers are following you. I was shocked to find out I've got over 300 people following me on Patreon, which is about... Yeah, that's about 300 more than I thought that I had. It was like,
wait, so now I'm gonna go check mine in a second here, but yeah. 300 followers, I didn't even know you had that. Like, what are they doing? Are they just
I'm gonna circle back to that because that's a very important thing to keep in mind. But before we do that, how many followers do you have?
Okay, I've logged in, I've checked, I have 325. Where are these people coming from? What are they doing? What is this?
Well, okay, I think some, just looking through the list, I think some of them are former backers that didn't want to lose touch completely. So they were like, okay, I'll become a follower instead of leaving completely. So what are your thoughts? How would you suggest converting these Patreon followers into Patreon backers?
Okay, so I have a couple of immediate thoughts now that I think about this as we talk. So I think you are right that probably a fair percentage of them are former patrons that like hard times came or they felt like they gave enough money or for whatever reason they moved on, and that's fine. But they want to be aware of any special offers or any public posts that might be made down the line where I should have made it private, but I forgot. So it's a public post or that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Or people that are like, I do want to back Dave again. Maybe they're doing what we suggested to that person last time. Like they have 50 people they follow and they rotate through them, right?
Right.
And so by following them, they know how to shift through their 6 or 10 or 12 or 50 artists that they're working through. That's one option. Another option is people that are on the fence. Like, oh, I found Brad Geiger. I'm now aware of Brad Geiger's Patreon page.
Yeah.
But I don't know that I want to pledge yet. But I want to keep it on. It's kind of a way of doing a mental bookmark. Like I'll follow them and then I'll get an occasional notice from them.
Yeah.
So my immediate thought on how to entice these people is if they are seeing the exclusive posts as headlines, and I don't know if they are or aren't, then part of us all should take a lesson from editorial page headline writers and really make enticing headlines to our Patreon posts.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of words like exclusives or sneak peek or only for your eyes or Patreon only or that kind of thing are like, oh my gosh, guys, wait till you see this. such that a follower, if in fact, Brad, these 300 people are checking in on Evilink but not yet backing, they're going to be like, what is behind all these secret posts? Like what?
Right.
Another exclusive, another Patreon only, wow, another for your eyes only. What is this? So you can use basic psychology on them. Another one is every once in a while, make a public post a month that says, like, here's what you'd get if you were a backer. I know that there's some people that follow that don't necessarily are not yet patrons, but this is your chance to jump in. Mm-hmm. And then if you can tie that to some form of either a formalized special offer or other thing, like, hey, there's been 10 other, even if it's not a special offer, even if it's just like there's been 10 other exclusive posts this week, what a great time to jump in and go check those out. You know, so you make your public post geared towards those 300 people.
Yeah.
That's my top of line thoughts, Brad. What are your top of line thoughts?
Well, it comes down to how you're doing Patreon in the first place. And there's a lot of different ways to do Patreon. The way that I have chosen to do it and the way that I advocate is exclusive content. And on the other side of the spectrum is the support-based Patreon. And there's right. a lot of divisions or gradations in between. Okay. You can do something that's heavily exclusive but has some support. You can have some support or heavily support with some exclusives. Whatever fits for you, what I found works best for me is to go heavily on the exclusive side. And as a result, I don't make hardly any public posts. There's for me and my philosophy, my way of thinking, it's absolutely pointless to make a public post on Patreon. Because there's lots of Patreon, again, is not for discovery. It's not for audience building. Patreon is for monetizing the audience that you've built. I've got lots of places to post my art, and I get a lot better return on investment for posting there. For example, social media, my own websites, newsletters, etc. So I don't make a lot of posts there. However, knowing that you do have these people following you, it is something to keep in the back of your mind if you're doing things the way I do, that every once in a while, it might be a good excuse or a good reason to make the odd public post. For example, just this October, as October is winding down here, I did a special offer that involved a Halloween e-comic for everybody that was signed up at the $10 level and higher. I made that announcement a public post, which was before I was even thinking about followers. I just thought, this is one that I'll make public. Anybody coming by can see it. It'll be easier to point to it from other sites and get people towards it. They won't have to be signed up to read it already. And that is something, along with the pro tip that we gave just recently on reaching out to former backers for a special offer, which, by the way, I'm still crunching the numbers on it. But so far, and this is the 29th of October that we're recording this, I've had 45 people sign up since I announced the special offer, and a good chunk of them are returning patrons. I've got to go back I'm going to have to go back and check everyone, you know, individually to get a number. But I just through the fact that I recognize a bunch of these names, it's like, oh, yeah, I remember you. You're good. That's great. Welcome back. So it is a good reminder to every now and again, like Dave said, maybe do a monthly wrap up. Here's everything that we did this month. We had a lot of fun. All the, you know, make sure you're conveying excitement in it. And definitely, if you're doing a special offer, that's definitely got to be a public post because your followers are going to get it. And of course, it's just going to be easier when you talk about it for your website. You can point to that public post. The public post does the conversion while they're there on Patreon, and hopefully they sign up. Aside from that, I don't think there's a whole lot that you can do. In other words, knowing that I've got 300 people following does not hardly change my approach at all. I'm not going to start making a whole bunch of public posts. There's no reason for it, but I will maybe do, like Dave said, once a month or once every 2 months.
Yeah. So I've got a couple follow-up thoughts on this. The nihilist in me has a very different opinion about this than the optimist in me. So The nihilist is like, look, if I haven't moved these people, they clearly clicked a button to follow. They could have clicked a button to pledge,
yeah,
but they didn't do it. So I don't know if I'm ever going to get them. Right? That's a nihilist in me. The optimist in me says they have expressed an interest. At some point, they expressed an interest, which is already a step up from a lot of the people, the tens of thousands of people that read it on the site. Here's 300 people that went to Patreon, looked at what Patreon was, said, ooh, I'm somewhat sparking on this. I'm going to become a follower, if not a backer yet. So the optimist in me is that I can get those people somehow. And like Brad said, it's either with a special offer or talking about exclusives or with special headlines that we might use that are enticing. And then the third one, Brad, or the fourth one, I don't know how many I had that list. The fourth one, is there a way to message just followers? Do we know that? I mean, I've only learned about this in the last hour, but do we know if there's a way to message just followers?
So if you go to your relationship manager and go to that first category, which is membership types, you can select followers. And then right underneath that, you'll see a little paper airplane icon that says message and then a number. So if you filter down your followers and you let the page reload, you'll now see, okay, I can message 362 people. So now I can click on that and send them a message through Patreon's messaging system, whatever I want to say.
Oh, all right. That is a game changer. That right there, that's how you do it. You create some kind of custom special offer time to time just to those followers, and you message it out, and it's not on the public transom. You know, it's not like, hey, everyone, I've got that. It's just a quieter thing like, hey, followers, I got something just for you. And I think.
Oh, man, that sounds nice and creepy. I love it.
Oh, did it?
Hey, followers, I've got something just for you.
Oh, that's I accidentally hit the Jim Hanks button. I'm sorry about that, Brad. Hey, I got hey, you Patreon followers, I got something special for you. Hi, I'm Jim Hanks. How you doing? Jim Hanks is going to hear this podcast. Yeah. He's like, what? What? I'm a nice guy. I'm Jim Hanks, for God's sakes. I'm the nicest guy going.
Yeah, you know, and the great thing about that is that I just put this together. Tom Hanks works 9 months out of the year and takes a 3-month vacation. Jim Hanks works 3 months out of the year and takes a 9-month vacation. Who's the smarter guy?
I love that phone call, though. Like, hey, Jim, it's Tom. I got you another gig. You're doing a Pizza Hut commercial. Hot damn, I'll be on the next flight to Los Angeles. All right, I'll see you, Tom. This is great.
Hey, if you're listening while you work, take a minute and stand and stretch.
And while you're doing that, Brad and I are going to tell you why you should join us on Patreon.
Yeah, because, you know, when you do, you'll get hours and hours of podcasts that we've recorded just for backers.
And an exclusive Patreon post that go even deeper on the Comic Lab topics.
And access to our exclusive Discord server, a thriving community of professional cartoonists.
So you can support the show you love and get tons of actionable resources for your own cartooning.
And listen, if you can't swing a pledge this month, no worries.
You can still support the show by rating us wherever you get podcasts.
Leave us a 5-star review and a few kind words.
And that, along with mentions on social media, is incredibly helpful.
And now, let's talk comics.
Well, just a reminder, the good news, Wacom, once again, our sponsor for Comic Lab over at WACOM.com. Wacom, the maker of fantastic Cintiqs and Intuos. Both Brad and I used them and found it delightful when they wanted to sponsor the show. Because how wonderful is it? It's not like we're selling Dr. Scholl's here. It's like, hey, this is something we use and love, and it's delightful. So we want to thank Wacom for sponsoring the show because we are legit big fans of how their products have impacted and affected and improved our cartooning, and it is a delight to have them as a sponsor. So Bradley J, what's our next question on the old list there, my friend?
David, our next question comes from a Patreon backer, Jeremy, who says, do you use Myers-Briggs personality types, MBTI, when defining any of your characters and how they would act in certain situations? And also, for more fun, what are your personality types? So two questions. We'll take the first one first. Dave, have you ever thought about using Myers-Briggs to do character building?
I have not. I am passingly aware of Myers-Briggs as a personality test and find it perfectly acceptable. I have no problems with it. But I don't personally use it in my own cartooning. But I think, Brad, you and I will both agree that if it works for someone, for God's sakes, why not use it to define and elucidate your characters? Really, any system that you want to use that helps you break down in a simplified way and really get down to the brass tacks of who this character is and what they are, then by all means, use it. Dive into it. And if Myers-Briggs helps you think of them like, oh, well, are they intuitive? Are they sensitive? Are they in, well, I don't remember what the other Myers-Briggs ones are, but then by all means, use it. It's a pre-existing system. It makes it easy to break out different kinds of characters. But for me personally, I don't. What about you, Brad? Have you ever used Myers-Briggs for a character or sketching out who somebody might be in your comics?
Nah, that really doesn't fit the way I think. But I'm just gonna echo what you said. When you're writing, so much of writing characters is organizing them in your head. In other words, this person, how would this person react? How would that person react?
Yes. Yep.
Who'd have the better reaction in that situation? I'm gonna put them in the center spotlight. And whatever it takes for you to organize that, do it. Dave, a while back, this might have been on a pro tips episode, but Dave talked about trying to distill your character down to one or two words, which I thought was really good. Myself, I tend to use other characters that they are a touchstone for me, like other characters either in literature or in pop culture. So you might write somebody who's kind of a Han Solo type, with the idea that you're not writing Han Solo, but when you say that in your head, it's like, oh, okay, I know you've got a whole list of things there. And then your character is that plus them. You can do any number of things. And if Myers-Briggs does it for you, then by all means do it. I could think of 100 worse things to do than that. It's something that I would have never come up with on my own. No.
Yeah. For me, it's just not a, never having taken a ton of psychology classes in college, I don't know that I'm, that's not my go-to for how to design a character. For me, it is years and years of really intense people watching. And I'm not joking about that. Like I am fascinated by different types of people and what makes them click. And as you can hear from the show, I often try to do voices as a way of understanding a type of person. For example, last night there was a woman on NPR who was, they were talking about the fires in Northern California, and she came on with this voice, and it was so specific that as a way of trying to understand what her worldview was, as I was driving, I was doing the voice because I was like, I think I can figure out who this woman is, how she would vote, what kind of groceries she would shop for, just trying to figure out this voice, you know?
Yeah.
And now, listen, is that a logical way to try to figure out a character? No, but for me, it works in that moment. Like, and I do that kind of stuff all the time when I hear spoken human voices. And I also, I love to, not in a creepy way, but when you're at a coffee shop, overhear conversations because you get snippets of personalities and ways of looking at the world. And for me, that's more helpful than, frankly, a scientific, logical, slice it up Myers-Briggs type of way of looking at a person. Mine is more feeling it out and maybe that's how I break out on the Myers-Briggs scales. So,
well, speaking of which, have you ever taken the Myers-Briggs test and figured out what your personality type was?
Well, hasn't everybody? I mean, it takes like 2 seconds online now that they have a bunch of varieties of Myers-Briggs online. I haven't done it in years, but I remember sitting around a kitchen table when we would have passed a laptop around and take the test and be like, I'm an ISPOOP-P4. I'm an MG910 or whatever it is, whatever their coding system is. And then everyone goes, isn't that interesting? And they all have a sip of their lager and they go on to whatever the next topic is. Because what actionable thing do you get from it? Like, I'm an IJS4. Oh, I'm an M5. Wow.
Nobody ever goes from that to immediately embroidering it on their sleeve, you know? Oh, what's that you got on your sleeve, Jerry? Oh, yeah, that's IMSB4. That's my Myers-Briggs type.
Yeah, for me, it's like when someone comes up to me at a party and goes, oh, I'm such a Capricorn. And I'm like, well, what am I supposed to make from that? For me, I get more of the fact that they said I'm such a Capricorn than the fact that they are a Capricorn.
That's
you know?
I was just going to say. You go, what am I supposed to take from that? And my first thought was, you're supposed to take that they're a dummy.
my first thought is, you're like, I'm such a Capricorn. And my takeaway is, hey, where's the cheese dip? Is it over there? I'm going to go look for the cheese dip.
There's got to be a fire exit around here somewhere.
You know what? I just realized I didn't set my hair. I've got to head home. I got to go. So,
Mercury's in retrograde, and I'm in the parking lot. Good night, everybody.
But while we're on the topic, I love that entire system was built upon where the stars were 2,000 to 3,000 years ago, and it doesn't even make sense anymore. Yeah, I'm like, that is delicious. That makes the cake.
I've met two people just within the last 2 years under the age of 25 who are very much into astrology.
Oh, Brad, I invite you to come to California, Brad. Welcome to every third conversation is someone talking about astrology.
Come on over, Brad.
I'll introduce you to all of California.
No. I'm perfectly happy right here.
You're
in Philadelphia.
I'm fine over here with my cheesesteak. I'll stay in Philly, thanks.
Yes.
Well, so let me ask you a question, Brad, and this one is right up your alley. Boy, I'm glad I finished that phrase. This one is right up your alley.
Alley.
Anyway, moving on. It's about charge up front on Patreon, because you and I have had this discussion / argument in the past. And I wanted you to talk about your thoughts about charging up front on Patreon. What is it? How does it work? And whether someone should or shouldn't. Can you take us through that?
I've got super strong feelings about this. And part of it is because I just legitimately feel strongly. And part of is because the solution is so simple that it really torques me that they haven't enacted it at Patreon.
Okay.
And I'm upfront about being very honest. I love Patreon a lot. They were a game changer for me, and I have a deep and abiding love for Patreon. If you've listened to the show, you know this. You know, I give them a long leash when it comes to things. But this one, it just upsets me to no end. So we'll start here. Charge up front is you've got two choices when you set your Patreon up. And I don't remember what the other way is called, so I'll just call it normal or traditional, where you set it up and the person joins your Patreon and they don't get charged until the end of the month. Technically, kind of, it's like I think they start charging cards on the 31st or the last day of the month, and it usually goes into the first or second day of the following month. So it kind of touches off at the end of the month. A lot of times, the cards aren't charged until the first or second, and that's kind of traditional. Now, the bad thing about that is somebody can join your Patreon on the 5th of the month, have access to all of your exclusive content, and jump out on the 29th of the month and never get charged. And that's called ghosting. And you can go back through earlier episodes. We've talked about that. And really, my idea or my philosophy is they can do that to me once. Then when they do that, I always check at the end of the month if anybody's done it. If they've done it, I block them. They can't become a Patreon backer again. And I move on. Because, you know, that's life. People do crappy things. Now, charge up front is where when people started ghosting, a lot of people ran to charge up front, because it works like this. When you join the person's Patreon, you get charged on that day. And then thereafter, you get charged on the last day of the month, every month thereafter. Well, that's a problem. It's great if today is the 5th of the month or the 3rd of the month, but what happens is when you get closer and closer to the end of the month, you take a tremendous risk that somebody it comes all the way to deciding to become a Patreon backer. And we've talked scads about how much work goes into that, right? You've got to repeat yourself 7 times on social media before people even get the message. You finally got them to go all the way to Patreon. They get there. They look at the notification because you're a charge up front, and they see I'm going to get charged right now, and I'm going to get charged on the last day of the month. If it's the 29th or even anywhere close, the 20th might be a cutoff, might be too soon for some people. They're going to say, oh, wait, I don't want to do this. I'm going to get charged twice right in a row, and they scram. And you've lost that person that you've been spending all this time trying to get them to this point of becoming a Patreon backer, and you lose them. That's why I don't do charge up front. I'll never do charge up front because, and this is such a simple fix, all you need is and you could do this, Patreon, if you're listening, you could do this in a Saturday afternoon of HTML coding. You wouldn't even have to go into anything complicated. You put a little button underneath that pledge button where if they click it, then their pledge goes through. Instead, right underneath of that, you say, remind me later. And then if it's too close to the end of the month, they click that button, put their email in, and then on the first of the following month, they get a reminder. Hey, you are going to become a Patreon backer of Brad's. It's the first of the month. This is a great time to do it. You're not going to pay twice in a row. It is the simplest solution in the world. They could do it in a Saturday afternoon, and it's been years, and they still haven't done it. It makes me really super upset. And so that's why I tell people, don't do charge up front. You're going to lose a bunch of potential Patreon backers at the end of the month. Dave, I know you disagree with me. So I'm gonna turn it over to you now. What's the counterpoint to that?
Well, first of all, no, in friendship, I want to acknowledge that Brad is right. Like it is there. I'm sure psychologically there's a percentage of people that go, oh, wait, it's the 27th and he's going to charge me again on the first. Nah, I'll just wait till the first. Right. Like I get that that's out there. I am very less convinced than Brad that that is dominant or even a problem. I think it's a very exceedingly small number of people for whom that is the case. Mm-hmm. And the problem for both Brad and I is that any proof one or the other of us might have is all anecdotal and passingly small, right? So I can't hold up numbers and go, see, Brad, see, I'm right. And Brad can't hold up numbers and go, see, I'm right. I'm the one that's right. And so we, on this one, we sort of agree to disagree because we like each other. But also, I do agree that there are two simple tricks that Brad's idea could build on. One is have that, hey, it's 10 days out from the end of the month. Do you really want to back now? Or would you like to be reminded on the first of the month? That's option number one. Yeah. Or I think most credit card charges will allow for a 3-day, like it has to be, the charge has to be made X number of hours after the card was entered, or else it becomes kind of a fraud thing. I believe that's the case. And so I think if it's like within 3 days, it'd be like, hey, we notice it's the 27th and you want to back Brad Geiger. Is it okay if we start you on the first and we'll charge this then? Yep, great. Or nope, go ahead and charge me now and charge me on the first. That's also fine. Right. So those two simple things they could do, I think. But then also my big, big thing here is that when you lock down someone in an emotional moment where they're ready to purchase something, doesn't matter what the thing is, there's a reason why Amazon created the one-click system and it's so easy. Because when you catch somebody in the right moment, that is the moment. It doesn't matter. Yes. Sometimes the numbers don't even make sense and it doesn't matter. They just want to buy the thing right now and they want to back Brad on Patreon right now and done. It's done. I don't want to wait 10 days. I don't want to be reminded in 10 days. I want to just get it done, right? I'm in the mental space and emotional space to do it now. I'm clicking the button and I back Brad. And so that's why I'm for charge up front. It's you don't get any ghosting and you catch people in the moment that they want to back. You're like, you're ready to back? Let's do it. Bam. Now you're a Sheldon backer. Now you're a Drive backer. You're in. And I don't know that people are, myself included, I don't know that anybody in that moment of emotional readiness to back is thinking, oh, but I'll be pinged again in 5 days. I think they're thinking to themselves, oh, I'm excited to be a backer. That's their emotional state right there, you know?
Oh, I can't. Well, I mean, again, what you said about anecdotal evidence is absolutely true. That's actually happened to me where I was like, oh, man, I really want to back this person. This looks really interesting. And I got there and it was like, oh, geez, it's the 25th. I'm going to pay twice right in the same week. I jumped out. But again, that's absolutely anecdotal.
So Brad, your anecdotal evidence is you. That's
Well, yeah. What do you think anecdotal evidence is? I just told you an anecdote.
This is Brad. You're right. But it's the equivalent of Brad going to a restaurant being like, no one order the drinks. That's where they make their money. We're just that's ordering food, water, kids. You're getting water. Everybody's getting water.
And don't fill up on bread.
Yeah, exactly. That's what they want you to do.
Yeah. And by the way, before you at us, and say, oh, there's other ways they can do it. They could do something. They could prorate the charge. They could do this. They could do that. Listen, there's a lot of things they could do. But my point is putting a little button there that sends them an email on the first of the month is a super simple way to addressing a very significant problem that I see. And prorating charges and all this other stuff or making it so that they get charged on the same day every month, which opens up a whole nother can of worms for them. It works for Patreon to do all their charges at the same time. Yes, it works for me if they would do it on the anniversary day of the month, but it doesn't work for them. And it needs to work for them. So yeah, I know there's other ways to do it. My point is there's a really simple solution. And it would assuage the biggest thing that, in my opinion, makes charge up front the bad decision for me. And it just irks me that it irks me that they're not doing things the way I think they should. The world is not spinning according to Brad, and it irks me.
Yeah, I know. Well, one thing I think we can both agree on, even though you and I, and it's not earth-shattering that we disagree on this. It's good that people hear the two different opinions. But
yeah.
I think we can both agree, Brad, in kindness, that it's actually more complicated than we think it is on how Patreon structures this. And that I give them credit that this is the central thing that they do, and it's more problematic. It must be more problematic than I think it is, given international credit card rules, given credit card rules, given the way fraud has to be prevented, all that sort of stuff, given the batching that credit card processing gives you in savings versus doing it on an annualized monthly basis, day to day to day. Like, I get all that. It must be more complicated because it would have been done better or differently if it was easier. I believe them when they say this is trickier than it looks.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
I actually do give them credit for that.
Yeah, yeah. And there's although I brought this up at like Patreon Community and Patreon and a number of different places, I'm sure if I talked to the right person, there's probably a very logical explanation for why they don't do it. but in my mind, it's like, it's exceedingly simple. And why don't they just do it? But life isn't like that.
Well, I mean, we could go through, Brad, we could play devil's advocate and go through all the options that you mentioned, and we can figure it out. Like, for example, if you say, well, look, the cost is diminished as the month goes on, does that mean that if I back on the first, it's full price? Does that mean on the second, it's 1/30th less, and on the third, it's 1/28th?
Well, like, that's why my solution is the email reminder. It's super simple. You put your email in and you get a reminder. There's no financial jumping that's got to be done.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, I, as I said at the beginning, I actually like Brad's idea. I think there's two ways you could do it. The Brad's reminder and then the credit card charge that's deferred if you're like 3 to 4 to 5 days out, depending on what the maximum limit is for you in your geographical region. Like, I know Europe has a different version than America of how far in advance you can take a credit card for a charge that's upcoming. But I do think Brad's idea of the email is right. And I do think that if you can potentially defray a charge for a few days until the first, but still capture someone signing up on the 27th, I think that's also great.
Right.
But I'm a big proponent of charge up front because you're capturing them in the emotional mood that is getting them excited to back Brad. And so capture them there. And then we'll figure out future months down the line. You know, like they clearly believe in you enough to give you money. I don't know that the vast majority of people are going to be going an extra dollar. I just gave one 4 days ago. You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, but my main level is $10.
That's true. And that is a lot. Yeah. Like, hey, on the 25th, I got charged $10, and then you know what? Yes. So I'm going to give a bigger caveat. It's more complicated for Brad than it is for me because my major level is five, and Brad's major level is 10. And you're right, Brad. Psychologically, that's a big difference.
It's a big ask.
Five to ten. Yeah, it is a big ask. I've always said Brad has a big ask. Well, let's move on. With the caveat that we agree to disagree, I think that at least clarifies some of the considerations for people. So why don't we move on to the next one, yeah?
Sounds good to me. So here is another question from a $5 Patreon backer who asks, I've got a question regarding hand shakiness. My art is very line work heavy, and it's something I prioritize in my art. However, I have very shaky hands due to some medical problems. I try to zoom in to hide this, but it's still pretty obvious that my lines are shaky when other people zoom into my art as well. It makes it difficult to draw sometimes. I was wondering if either of you had any tips on better controlling an uncontrollable hand. Thank you. I love your show. Dave Kellett, give this poor cartoonist a little advice on the shaky line.
This is a unique and interesting question. So the first thing I should mention is that I have actually experienced this when I had costoclavicular syndrome for about 2 or 3 years there. My line and my overall musculoskeletal control on my right hand got really shaky because the basic nerve bundle at my shoulder leading down to my right arm was just jacked. It was all messed up. It took like 2 years of PT to fix it. So anyway, my hand would, I think I've talked about this before. My hand would go cold. I would drop plates. I couldn't hold a pen very well. It would be loose. And then when I could hold it, it was very shaky. So I very much relate to this problem. My dog's barking in the background. I don't know if you can hear that. So I'm very sympathetic to the moment that you're in because, I can imagine 1,000 situations that could be causing this shakiness, whether it's medication, whether it's an injury, whether it's a degenerative disease, a musculoskeletal problem, a nerve problem. There's 1,000 reasons why your hand might be shaking. And so let's talk about what historically people have done. Charles Schultz, the last, I don't know, Brad, what would we say, 10 to 15 years of his career?
Absolutely.
Got a really shaky line with his pen, really shaky. But if you can in your life, try to find a Peanuts original, because one of the reasons why he drew gigantic was to kind of hide the fact, like you're doing right now, probably in Photoshop, drawing gigantic so that it kind of hid the shakiness of his line. And I think allowed him to use more major muscle groups than smaller, minor muscle groups in his hand. Other people that have also gone through problems like Monet literally going blind. And so his paintings reflected that as he got more and more blind. But one of the things with art is that a part of you might be like, if you used to have a steady line, it might be the ego of wishing that you could still maintain that steady line when maybe a shaky line is your new normal. And maybe that's okay. And maybe that might just be a coming to peace with that. But then I also think you're on the right path with trying to draw big. I think that's worked for Schultz. It worked for me when I was doing, trying to work through my costoclavicular syndrome. I'm trying to think of other things. Like I have a passing memory that a friend of mine, when he was drawing with Parkinson's, would put an ankle weight on his forearm, Brad. Do you know what an ankle weight is? Like those loose kind of bags of sand that you tie around your ankles?
Yeah.
He would keep it to kind of hold down because it wouldn't immediately wipe away everything, but it would minimize a little bit the major muscle shaking so that the minor muscles could work. It wasn't a perfect solution, but I do remember that. But even then, your body is fighting against a weight on, and that's not necessarily great. What do you have, Brad? I've been talking too long. What suggestions might you have?
I think your advice is dead on, and I'm just going to underline the two things you said. In other words, the question asker said that they zoom in to hide it. And I think if you're doing this digitally, you want to zoom out, which is the equivalent of drawing large. In other words, if you've got a shaky hand, you want to make bigger lines faster, and that's going to be zooming out. If you go in and you're making these real, if you're just covering a little bit of space with your hand, I would think that that's going to be a little harder on you. I would say number one, zoom out a little bit. Number two, up the tempo of your drawing. In other words, the quicker you move your hand across the page, the less time it's got to shake.
Right.
You're right. So that's something I learned at art school. You know, if you want to make a more smooth line, draw faster. Because if you draw slow, then the natural quiver of your muscle groups are gonna show. So up your tempo, zoom out a little bit. And the third thing that Dave said, it is worth repeating, realize that this might be your new art. And in the same way that Charles Schultz's wavy line has its own beauty, so does yours. It's not the beauty that you thought you were going to have, but it's still beautiful and it still has its own value. And again, I go back and read your question. It's still pretty obvious that my lines are shaky when other people zoom into my art.
Ah, yeah.
Listen, nobody's zooming into your art. All right. I mean, maybe one or two. I'm sure your art is great. But remember, people read comics in a split second. 85% of the people reading your comics are reading them in a split second. They're going from panel to panel to panel to panel. They're not going panel and then zooming in and luxuriating over the lines that you put into this guy's cufflink. No, they're going on to the next panel. They're not zooming in. You've got a little bit more leeway. This is like anything else that is, especially something where you're like, my body is different, right? You've got a medical problem. It's introduced a shake to your hand. That's kind of demoralizing, and it's frightening. And like all of the things that happen in this regard, we feel like everybody's right. looking at us, right? Like anytime you've ever had a Band-Aid on your face, it's like 110 people walking around the world have Band-Aids and worse on their face, but you feel like everybody's looking at you. And this is kind of the same thing. And I'm not downplaying it. I'm saying it's very natural to say, oh my gosh, everybody can see this. All they got to do is zoom in. Well, it's okay. The comics don't get read that way. Comics get read bing, yep. bing, 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 bing. And I think you can take it easy on yourself. Prioritize whatever those medical problems are, and address those, and take it easy on yourself on the rest. You're doing good work. I'm sure of it. Don't being hypercritical on zoomed in lines to the problems that you may be dealing with.
Right. So other solutions to talk about, you may have grown up and trained yourself or gone to school and trained towards a single line that's clear and pure, and you were happy with it. And you're like, damn it, now my line's all shaky. And I get that. Mm-hmm. Another thing that I might suggest is to make a line with thousands of small lines. And to that, I would suggest if you ever get the chance in life, look at an original Al Hirschfeld, who did Broadway caricatures and movie posters for Hollywood. Mm-hmm. His originals... You look at a line, you're like, it's so smooth. It's like vector. How did he do that, Cary Grant? That's an amazing Cary Grant. And then you go and look at one of his originals, and one line, Brad, is drawn up by thousands of small lines. Like
really?
He's back and forth, back and forth, like building up a line slowly, right? So that's one
wow.
solution. And then another one that I can think of now that we're talking more is to let math do the work for you. And there are a couple of drawing programs now that allow for smoothing. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Illustrator does it, so you can draw in vector now, and that's getting better and better,
yeah.
where you let the math of the vector lines smooth out whatever wiggle you might have had, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's just a matter of getting down to the granular nitty-gritty of the settings that you want to change it to so that it finds the right amount of curve but not the wiggle, right, or the shaking.
Mm-hmm.
And then other programs that allow for that, Procreate also, if I remember correctly, I've only fiddled with it. I haven't drawn with it for a long time. But I think that has mathematical smoothing as well of shaky lines.
Mm-hmm.
And so you might want to check that out. I think that's only like a $7 or $10 program. So you can look for that one.
And
then,
of course,
Brad, you can... go ahead. What was the other one?
I'll just add Clip Studio Paint, your drawing tools in CSP have a stabilization factor, and you can up that stabilization. And that I've done that a few times when I've had a cup of coffee too much. It's like, oh, geez, I need to stable this line a little bit. I'll monkey around with that stabilization on a monthly basis, depending on whether I need a little bit more or a little less help.
Yeah, so stabilization or a stable line or smoothing, those are the phrases mm-hmm. you want to do Google searches for whatever apps you draw in. I don't know, Brad, because it's raster, I don't know that Photoshop offers a smoothing. Do you? I don't think they do.
I don't know. I'm sure somebody will write in and tell us, but I'm not aware of a smoothing factor in Photoshop.
Yeah, but at the very least, you have three options of programs that hopefully are within reach for you, mm-hmm. Illustrator, CSP, or Procreate. And so I hope that the couple of different answers we gave you there are helpful. But I hope more than anything else, I hope that you keep drawing despite this moment, because there's something wonderful about discovering a new style amongst hardships. And frankly, in the 2 or 3 years where I was drawing with pain and a cold hand and muscles that weren't working and nerves that were shaking, I kind of changed my style with drive. I could almost point out the month or two where it started to really change.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes there's growth opportunities amongst a shitty moment, you know? And that sounds Pollyanna-ish and probably is not what you want to hear right now. But there is a moment where you can go like, all right, well, maybe I change up my style a little bit. What if I drew like this? What if I drew like that? You know, that kind
yeah.
of thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so anyway, I think both Brad and I wish you all the best and hope you keep drawing. It sounds like you will. Hope that some of these answers were helpful to you.
Yeah, and listen, one more point about smoothing a line. I've got a nice smooth line for you right here, and it's this. You've been listening to Comic Lab, the show about making comics and making a living from comics.
Your hosts have been the ever smooth. Oh, that sounds terrible. Your hosts have been Brad Geiger, the editor of webcomics.com and cartoonist of Evil Inc. at evil-comic.com.
And my friend, Dave Kellett, co-director of Stripped and cartoonist of Sheldon at sheldoncomics.com and Drive at drivecomic.com.
This week's sponsors now through the rest of 2019, our buddies over at Wacom at WACOM.com. Go check them out. Makers of Cintiq and Intuos and a bunch of other amazing drawing products. We use them ourselves, Wacom.com. And the Comic Lab theme song is used with permission from Andy Creighton at theworldrecord.net. And this episode and all episodes was edited by Matt Woodard of Woodsong Productions over at www.woodsong.media.
Comic Lab is made possible by your support on patreon.com/comiclab. So we'll go ahead and say that twice. Patreon.com/comiclab. Oh, wait a minute. It's Jim Hanks's brother. Guy, come on in.
Oh my gosh, Tom Hanks! Nope, that was Jim Hanks. We sound identical. Oh, Tom Hanks, you're here!
Hey, it's me, Tom Hanks! Nailed it.
Nailed it.